So tonight we're picking up in Malachi, the first part. We're going to cover Malachi 1, 6 through 14. And then in the second part, Malachi 2, 1 through 9. And I've put these two sections together because it is an address that pertains to the priests. And so I want to read Malachi 1, 6 through 14. And then we'll come back and we'll look at it more carefully. I'm reading from the New American Standard Bible. So Malachi 1:6, a son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says the Lord of hosts to you, O priests who despise my name. But you say, how have we despised your name? You are presenting defiled food upon my altar. But you say, how have we defiled you? In that you say the table of the Lord is to be despised. But when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your governor? Would he be pleased with you? Or would he receive you kindly, says the Lord of hosts? But now, will you not entreat God's favor, that he may be gracious to us? With such an offering on your part, will he receive any of you kindly, says the Lord of hosts. Oh, that there were one among you who would shut the gates, that you might not uselessly kindle fire on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says the Lord of hosts, nor will I accept an offering from you. For from the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations, and in every place incense is going to be offered to my name. And a grain offering that is pure, for my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. But you are profaning it, in that you say the table of the Lord is defiled, and as for its fruit, its food is to be despised. You also say, my, how tiresome it is. And you disdain it, and you disdainfully sniff at it, says the Lord of hosts. And you bring what was taken by robbery, and what is lame or sick, so you bring the offering. Should I receive that from your hand, says the Lord of hosts? But cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows it, but sacrifices a blemished animal to the Lord. For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name is feared among the nations. Now I want to go down and look at the summary in my notes, and then we'll come back and look at it. Basically, what we have here is God rebuking the priests in Judah who have disdained his name by offering unacceptable sacrifices on the altar. That's the basic point of this particular unit, this pericope. And so let's go back and we'll start at it, and we'll start in Malachi 1:6. And he says, a son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says the Lord of hosts. O priests who despise my name. Now I underscored that section there, O priests who despise my name, because that is the audience. Anytime you're looking at a passage, you want to ask who's the author, who's the audience, what is being addressed. Because we want to be able to orient to the time and the culture of what's going on. And so the priests are specifically identified here in this passage. And we'll see that as we continue on through Malachi chapter 2 to the end of verse 9. Because he continues on with this direct address to the priests. And this is God the Father talking through his prophet Malachi. And he sets up a comparison here. He says, a son honors his father. That is, a good son honors his father. And a servant his master. That is, a good servant. And just as a son will honor his father, and just as a master will obey, or just as a servant will obey his master, logically you would think that those who call God Father and who recognize him as Lord would honor him and would serve him. And so that's the follow-up, where he says, a son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says the Lord of hosts. Now that phrase, Lord of hosts, some translations will translate it Lord of the armies, because that's what the phrase means. And when it talks about him being the Lord of the armies, he is the Lord of the armies of heaven and earth. He is the supreme commander, we might say, in the ultimate sense. But he's establishing himself as one who has authority, one who has the right to command. And who is he addressing? Well, he's specifically addressing the priests. And he says, "O priests who despise my name." Now, when we talk about the name of God, when we talk about God's name, there's two major views with regard to the name of God. One is that it refers to his essence, that is the sum of who he is, his character, his attributes. But it's also understood that when it's talking about his name, it's talking about his reputation. Because how the priests function, how they handle themselves, how they live, is a reflection of the person and the character of God. And so if they behave poorly, then what it does is it basically impugns the very name of God. It impugns his reputation, as it were. And so he's talking to the priests here, and he says, "O priests who despise my name." And you can see the reference to his name in other verses, like down in Malachi 1:11. He mentions that again, where he says, "From the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name," and again, think of the idea of his reputation, "my name will be great among the nations." And then down in chapter 2, verse 2, "If you do not listen, if you do not take it to heart to give honor to my name, says the Lord of hosts, then I will send a curse upon you." And then down in verse 5, "My covenant was with him, was one of life and peace, and I gave them to him as an object of reverence. So he revered me and stood in awe of my name." And so this idea of God's reputation, born out of his character, no doubt. But the reference to the name here, when he's accusing the priest, because he's setting a charge to the priest, isn't he? "O priests who despise my name." Now, they wouldn't necessarily be doing this verbally. How they're despising the name of God is through their life, that how they conduct themselves, that they are disobedient to the Lord. And so in this sense, they are despising the name of the Lord. And they challenge his claim. "But you say," and here he's talking with the priestly response, "how have we despised your name?" And what we see here is a challenge to the accusation set forth by the priest. Well, God gives an answer. He says, and this is how they are despising his name, "You are presenting defiled food upon my altar." You are presenting defiled food upon my altar. So that is how they are despising the name of the Lord, because they are not serving properly as a priest. They are not representing the character of God, the reputation of God, the name of God. And this is manifest through their lifestyle. So he says, "You are presenting defiled food upon my altar." They come back with a challenge, "But you say, how have we defiled you?" Again, challenging the accusation. And God replies, "In that you say," and this would be not that they say verbally, but it would be by their actions, "in that you say the table of the Lord is to be despised." Now that's interesting there, because in the first part of verse 7, he calls it my altar. But in the latter part of verse 7, he calls it the table of the Lord. And the idea of a table is the idea of where somebody comes together for like a communal meal, to fellowship together. So the altar, in a sense, becomes the table where the priests would bring the sacrifices and they would come together, and it was the place of communing with the Lord. So he says the table, and by the way, he's about to give a comparison here with regard to the governor. But he says the table of the Lord is to be despised. And you can see an example of that over in Ezekiel 44, verse 16. There's other places, but this is a good example. Ezekiel chapter 44, verse 16. I can find my place there. Where he says, then they shall enter my sanctuary, they shall come near to my table to minister to me and to keep my charge. So this idea of coming near the table, again, is this idea of coming into the place of fellowship. Verse 8, God carries on with the charge. He says, but when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? Now here he's talking about the blind animal that was brought to the altar for sacrifice. He says, and when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Now, the priests were actually forbidden from offering animals that were blemished, animals that were imperfect. Go back with me to Leviticus chapter 1, verse 3. Leviticus chapter 1, verse 3. He says, if his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it, here it is, a male without defect. So an animal that was presented that was blind or lame or sick would be really, according to the law, an unacceptable sacrifice. He was the offerer was to offer an animal, a male, without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. And so coming and worshiping is a right thing. Coming and offering the sacrifice was a right thing, but a right thing has to be done in a right way. A right thing has to be done in a right way. We can also look at Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 21. Deuteronomy 15, verse 21. Where he says, but if it has, here he's talking about the sacrifice, but if it has any defect, such as lameness or blindness, or any such defect, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. So the priest, the charge to the priests here is that they were bringing unacceptable sacrifices. They were bringing animal sacrifices that were blind, that were lame, that were sick, and twice God says, is this not evil? Is this not evil? He says it twice in the verse. Now, in the latter part of verse 8, God says, why not offer it to your governor? That is, to the governor of the land. And the idea is that that they would not do this. They would not offer it to their governor. They would not dare to bring such an animal to be sacrificed for a communal meal. But he says, why not offer it to your governor? That is, when you come to sit at his table for fellowship. And then he poses the question, would he be pleased with you? And the answer is what? The answer is emphatically, no, he would not. And then he asks the second question, or would he receive you kindly? That is, would he receive you kindly for bringing garbage to dinner? And the answer is, no, he would not. So again, would he be pleased with you or would he receive you kindly, says the Lord of hosts? And the answer is obviously a no. It's an emphatic no. Well, if it's true that the governor of the land would not accept such a sacrifice, then why would the God of the universe accept such a sacrifice? And so God is arguing a case here. He's arguing a case before them. Verse 9, he says, but now will you not entreat God's favor? And so God is gracious to them here. We're about to see that even more so once we jump into the second hour here. He says, but will you not entreat God's favor? And the way to entreat God's favor would be through humbling themselves and by doing his will. That would be the way to do it, by humbling themselves and by doing his will. So he says, but now will you not entreat God's favor that he may be gracious to us? He says, for with such an offering on your part, will he receive any of you kindly? Now, the offering here he's talking about is an unacceptable offering. With such an offering on your part, will he receive any of you kindly? And with an unacceptable offering, the answer would be no, that he would not, says the Lord of hosts. And then in verse 10, he says, oh, that there were one among you who would shut the gates. that you might not uselessly kindle fire on my altar. I am not pleased with you, says the Lord of hosts, nor will I accept an offering from you. So when he says, oh, that there were one among you, when he's talking about one among you, he's talking about one of the priests. And what is he arguing here when he says, oh, that there would be one among you who would shut the gates? That is, you know, it would be nice if there was at least one priest among the priesthood that would basically shut the doors to the temple courtyard. Just close the whole thing off. Just shut the whole thing down. Don't even bring any sacrifices. If what you're going to bring is an unacceptable sacrifice, if what you're going to bring is blind and lame and sick, then just don't even bring it at all. It's better that they just shut the gates and not even bring any sacrifices at all. So again, oh, that there were one among you who would shut the gates, that you might not uselessly kindle fire on my altar. And so he says, I am not pleased with you, says the Lord of hosts. And he's not pleased with them because they failed to operate by faith and to do as he instructed. And he says, nor will I accept an offering from you. So God makes it very clear that he is not going to accept their blind and lame and sick offerings. Verse 11. Now, verse 11 is a bit of a challenging verse. He says in verse 11, he says, for from the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations. Now, the nations here would be the Gentile nations, verse 11. My name will be great among the nations. And in every place, incense is going to be offered to my name and grain offering that is pure. For my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. And I think that this verse is talking about in the future. I think he's talking about a future time when God's name among the nations will be exalted. He says, for from the rising of the sun even to its setting, my name will be great among the nations. And in every place, incense is going to be offered to my name and a grain offering that is pure. He says, for my name will be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts. And this is, I think, intended to get the audience to be aware of what God expects, not only of them, but what will be expected of future generations, future Gentile generations. Now, in verse 12, he says, but you, coming back to the priests here, but you are profaning it. So again, going back to the priests, in Malachi's day, but you are profaning it. And they were profaning it again through corrupt worship. In that you say, and again, they were saying this by their actions, in that you say, the table of the Lord is defiled. And as for its fruit, its food is to be despised. So basically, by bringing the unacceptable sacrifices, they declared that it was all right to defile the Lord's table. Now, these were the spiritual leaders in Israel at this time. This is the priesthood. And so by accepting these unacceptable sacrifices, what they were doing was they were telling everybody who brought them that it was all right to come and to offer these sacrifices, that it was okay to bring these to the Lord. Not only that, but apparently they were tired of the work. Verse 13, he says, you also say, my, how tiresome it is, that is, to offer the sacrifices. Now, these are people who have lost their passion for ministry. And this is obvious because at this point, it's just become drudgery to them. And they just talk about how tiring it is to come and to do this thing. And it's obvious because they've really become quite sloppy. They're, again, accepting these unacceptable sacrifices. But the attitude of the priesthood at this time, he says, but their attitude was, my, how tiresome it is. And you disdainfully sniff at it. And it's almost a repugnancy, you know, that they just kind of like, you know, put their nose in the air like, oh, how repulsive. You know, they didn't like it. They were not doing it as unto the Lord, for sure. But you also say, my, how tiresome it is, and you disdainfully sniff at it, says the Lord of hosts. And then he goes on, and you bring what was taken by robbery, that is stolen food, and what is lame or sick, so you bring the offering. And again, this is the unacceptable offering that the priests were bringing to the Lord. And he poses the question again, should I receive that from your hand, says the Lord? And the obvious answer is no, he should not. And he says, but cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows it, but sacrifices a blemished animal to the Lord. For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name is feared among the nations. But when he says, cursed be the swindler, this is the one who vows one thing and then gives another. One who vows one thing and gives another. So cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock, and that is a healthy male. So he has an animal that would be an acceptable offering to the Lord. He has a healthy male in his flock, and he vows it. He even says, this is the one that I'm going to give. But, and the but would give the idea of instead of, but sacrifices a blemished animal to the Lord. So he's got a healthy male, and he vows the healthy male, but then when it comes time to bring the animal to the temple, he brings the sick animal instead. And God says, for I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name is feared among the nations. So what we see here, again, as I mentioned at the very beginning, is that God is rebuking the priests in Judah who have disdained his name by offering unacceptable sacrifices on the altar. Now let me go through the summary notes here, and we'll probably chase down a few other verses as we go through this, and I've got some quotes in here as well. Now in this pericope, in this unit of thought, God admonishes the priests in Judah who failed in their temple duties. And the Lord opens with the comment that a good son honors his father, and a good servant respects his master, but God's priests disrespect him and despise his name. Now the word despise translates the Hebrew word bagza, which means to look down on something, to look down on someone or something as worthless. Now what we see here is that when they talk about despising the name of God, really by offering the lesser sacrifice, what they were really despising was really the Lord himself. And I have a quote here from Dr. Alan P. Ross from his commentary on Malachi where he says that. He says, quote, they did not simply despise the Lord in the way that they worshiped. He says the way they worshiped shows that they were despisers of the Lord. End quote. And he's absolutely right. And so what we're seeing is the sacrifice they offered was really the symptom of a much larger issue. It was the outgrowth, the byproduct of something really else that was going on. And it was really their attitude toward God. And we might even say that they had become cold in their walk with the Lord, that their passion for the Lord had died off. And at that moment, there was no passion for ministry. There was no passion for the Lord. There was no love of the Lord. There was no desire to do the work of the Lord. And for them, what may have started out as a true passionate thing, where the fire may have been there for them to serve the Lord, over time began to taper off and they grew cold. And then the work itself, well, the ministry itself was no longer something that was true, that was passionate. It just became work. It just became drudgery. And they were tired of it, and they got sloppy in it, and they were willing to take whatever came their way. And they were willing to show partiality, and in that sense, they were dishonoring the Lord himself. Now going on in the notes here, the priests ask how they are guilty of despising the Lord, and God answers by presenting defiled food upon my altar. The sacrificial altar is also called the table of the Lord in Malachi 1:7. Identifying it as the place where people came together not only to sacrifice but to eat and to fellowship. Now in ancient Israel, the communal meal was more than a source of nutrition. It also communicated a place of worship, trust, and respect. Now I put in here in the notes over in Genesis chapter 18, I want you to see this. Go back to me to Genesis 18, because I think this kind of sets the tone for how the meal was received and how they thought about a communal meal. And over in Genesis 18, we have the introduction to this narrative that leads to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in Genesis 18 and 1, it says, "Now the Lord appeared to him," that is, this is a theophany, it's an Old Testament appearance of God, where he comes and he presents himself to Abraham. It says, "Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. And when he lifted up his eyes, he looked, and behold, three men standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself down to the earth." And this was a display of hospitality. And notice, he runs to them. He comes to them. He greets them very quickly. And he said, verse 3, "My Lord, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree." A great display of hospitality. And by the way, strangers who passed through the land, when they ran into people, if you didn't display yourself as being friendly and hospitable up front, well, then it might put a question mark as to whether or not you were truly a friend or a foe. And so I think that this display kind of establishes Abraham up front as a person who could be trusted, a person who was friendly to visitors, to passersby. Because again, when you're out there by yourself, this can be a dangerous place. And I think this is true today. I think even today we live in a world where there's hostility, where there's a general sense of mistrust and fear. And people sometimes, when they come and they meet somebody new, there's a question mark. And I don't think people often think about it themselves. I remember listening to a teacher a couple years ago, and he was talking about how our culture has become so hostile that in people's minds, one of the first questions they ask themselves is, "Are you safe?" Not that they articulate that to themselves, but it's sort of an underlying thing within them. So they want to know, "Are you safe?" Now, they may ask follow-up questions like, "Are you competent? Are you caring?" You know, this other secondary and tertiary questions. But they want to know that you're safe. And I know that I have made it a practice that when I meet somebody, the very first thing as I do is I will smile at them. I will greet them. I'm kind to them. Even when I'm walking through the neighborhood, if I see somebody and they lock eyes with me, I move quick. I'm like, "Hi, howdy, neighbor. How you doing?" You know, quick greeting. Because you want to establish very clearly up front you're a friend. And so, you know, in this culture, this issue of trust and safety was very important, very important. And so Abraham here presents himself. He says, "Do not pass your servant by." He puts himself in the category of a servant in the latter part of verse 3. And he says, "Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree." And notice that he's offering them comfort. He's offering them safety. He's wanting them to feel comfortable. And notice verse 5, "And I will bring a piece of bread." Now he's talking about a meal. He's talking about offering them something that when you invite somebody to a table, you're inviting them into the place of trust. You're inviting them into the place of fellowship. And that's a very intimate thing. That's a very intimate thing. And to have a meal with somebody in the ancient world was to basically invite them into your inner circle of trust. It was quite a big deal. I mean, we take it today. We sit down, we eat, and we gobble up our meal, and we yak-yak, and we chat, and we burn up, we go do our thing. But for them, it was a much bigger issue. To invite somebody to your table was, I mean, it was a big statement. But you were establishing that you were trustworthy. And he says, "And I will bring a piece of bread that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on. Since you have visited again your servant." And notice he's calling himself, he's identifying himself as their servant. "And they said, do as you have said." So they accept his kind offer. Now, I don't think he realizes that this is the Lord and there's two angels with him, because later on they're going to go down to Sodom and we know who they are. They're identified. Verse 6, "So Abraham hurried." This is a man on the move, right? "So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, quickly, prepare 3 measures of fine flour." The quality of the meal here matters. 3 measures of fine flour. "Knead it and make bread cakes." After that, he runs out of the tent. And he's a man on the run again. So verse 7, "Abraham also said to the herd," he ran to the herd, "and he took a tender and choice calf." Now, don't miss that. This was a tender and it was choice. It was the best of the flock. Because again, what you offered to the person who was receiving the meal said something about how you viewed that person. that if you offer them the best, it means that you're elevating them. You don't offer them cheap food, okay? So Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant, and he hurried and prepared it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them, and he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Abraham here presents himself as a servant to them. There's a picture of humility here, a picture of fellowship. But he's offering the best that he has for safety, for comfort, for nourishment. And again, this is the picture that is being put forth here. So you put that in contrast to what the priests are offering, that they're bringing to the altar here to the Lord. What they're offering to the Lord is the blind, the sick, the lame. And what they're doing is it's actually how they think about the Lord. That it's an estimation of what they think of Him. Not just the offering itself, but what they think of Him. And this is the charge that is being brought to the priests. So again here, that it's called the altar of the Lord, identifying it as the place where people came together, not only to eat, not only for nutrition, not only for sacrifice, but to eat and to fellowship. And again, in ancient Israel, the communal meal was more than a source of nutrition. It communicated a place of fellowship, a place of trust, and a place of respect. That what you think about the person who's receiving the meal. Now going on in the notes here, the priest dishonored the Lord by offering blind, lame, and sick animal sacrifices, which were forbidden under the Mosaic law. And we looked at Leviticus 1:3 and Deuteronomy 15:21 very clearly. These were not acceptable. Look, God made it very clear that these were unacceptable. And though the priests were the ones primarily being rebuked, it also includes the offerers who were bringing these. The offerers were also guilty. So the message is primarily to the priests, but the fact that the offerers brought these blind and sick and lame animals made them guilty as well in a secondary sense. But it was the priests who were the keepers of the temple gates. They were the ones who were allowing these sacrifices to come in. They were the ones who were inspecting the animals. They were the ones who were offering them on the altar. And so the primary guilty party here is the priests. So though the priests were the ones primarily being rebuked, the offerers were also guilty, for they were the ones bringing the unacceptable sacrifices. The quality and attitude of the gift says something about the giver and his or her estimation of the recipient. Let me say that again. The quality and attitude of the gift says something about the giver and his or her estimation of the recipient. Now here, I thought about two New Testament references. One is the one where you have the poor widow who, though she only gave two coins, gave with the right attitude. She gave with the right attitude. And then you also think of Mary's gift to Jesus was also precious. Go with me over to John chapter 12. John chapter 12. We'll look at that one. In John chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, and what we have here is we have literally about a week before the crucifixion of Christ is the time frame here in the Gospel of John. And he says here in John chapter 12, verse 1, Jesus, therefore, 6 days before the Passover he came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they made him supper there, and Martha was serving, but Lazarus was one of those who were reclining at the table with him. Verse 3, Mary then took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and the whole house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Well, you say, well, just how costly was this? Well, let's read on. It says here, but Judas, one of his disciples who was intending to betray him, already had it on his mind. He said, why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people? Well, 300 denarii, a denarii was a day's wage. So if you're talking about 300 denarii, you're basically talking about a year's salary. That's a pretty costly bottle of perfume. And the fact that Mary takes this bottle and without hesitation does what? She pours it on the feet of Jesus, and then she wipes his feet with her hair. And a woman's hair was also a valuable commodity in that culture. It was a beautiful thing. It was a sign of her glory and her honor, so to speak. And so the fact that she is willing to humble herself and to do this thing for Jesus says something about the recipient. Because what you give, the gift and the value of the gift and the worth of the gift, says something about the person that you're giving it to, what you think of that person. Now, Judas was all upset over this. He was all wrapped around the axle. But verse 6 tells us, now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. And as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. So, you know, he makes this public thing, you know. And by the way, it goes to show that those who have talk about helping the poor aren't always true in their motive. But he, you know, he talks about why wasn't this sold and given to the poor? And he really didn't care about the poor. He was just concerned that his own pockets weren't going to be lined, because if this had been sold and the money put in the box, he would have taken out his, you know, 10% or whatever. But Jesus said, verse 7, said to her, let her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. And so Mary, knowing this about Christ, that the time was short, she then offers this very costly perfume to him. And again, what is given says something about the giver's attitude towards the recipient. And so put that back into the context of what we're talking about here with the priests who were offering these sacrifices on the altar. Again, it says something about their attitude. Now, I have another quote here by Dr. Alan P. Ross from his commentary on Malachi, which I love. I love Dr. Ross. He's great, and his commentary on Malachi is very good. But quoting here from Dr. Ross, he says, when the people came to worship, God did not require a great deal of them in the way of offerings. Tokens, really, of their herds and their crops. A handful of grain or an animal or two for the family. Now, I want to stop there for just a second to comment on that, because he talks about what God really asked of them. He calls it tokens of their herds and crops. Because if you, let's say you have a herd of, oh, I don't know, 1,500, 2,000 cattle or sheep or goats. I mean, what is it to bring one? You know, if you've got 150 or 200 acres of land, what is it for you to bring a handful of grain or fruit of the ground? What is that? It's a token. It's just a very small thing to give. And so if you've got, you know, those kind of herds, those kind of animals, then really what God was asking them to bring was really just a small token. This was not a big sacrifice on their part. And so you just keep that in mind. So I'm going to start over with the quote here. He says, when the people came to worship, God did not require a great deal of them in the way of offerings, tokens really, of their herds and of their crops, a handful of grain or an animal or two for the family. But what they brought had to pass two important tests. And in many cases, only they and God would know if they passed them. Now that's another interesting point. I'm going to pause there for just a second, because it's not like a priest was going to go out and inspect the herd. Like he was going to go out and look at all 2,000 head of cattle and compare it to the one that was brought and say, oh, gee, this isn't the best. It's not the top of the herd heap here. So really when they brought it was really something that really was only known between them and God as to whether or not they brought the best. So going back here to Ross, he says, but what they brought had to pass two important tests, and in many cases only they and God would know if they passed them. He goes on to say, what they brought had to be the first and the best. He says, the first of their flock and the best animal that they had. Anything less than this was an insult to God. To bring an inferior gift would say that one did not think much of God. For the quality of the gift indicates the value the giver places on the one receiving the gift. He closes out. He says, this is true in a human relationship, and it is certainly true in worship. End quote. And I love that. And I think he absolutely nails it. And so going on here in the notes, and I'm going to close out here with this. God, being God, is very gracious to them. And he offers them grace in verse 9. But God, being gracious, offers them grace if they would humble themselves. In other words, God says, look, seek my favor. I'll be gracious to you. We'll hit the pause button, and we'll stop and we'll restart this. We'll just start here fresh and move forward. And so he's really offering them a chance to restart the proper worship. But he makes it very clear that if they would not obey, he says, basically, it would be better if one of the priests would just simply shut the doors of the temple courtyard rather than offer improper sacrifices. You know, he says, would that one of you just shut the gates? I mean, if this is what you're going to keep on bringing, let's just shut the whole system down. Don't even open the doors. Because if that's what you're going to bring me, well, let's not waste your time and let's not waste my time. So he says it would be better to just shut the gates rather than to allow this to continue. Now, God's name is very important, for it represents his divine nature, and he desires that it be honored in all places, starting in Israel and Judah at this point in history, but also among all the nations. And by the way, I was talking with a friend earlier, a seminary friend, and we were talking about how, you know, you hear the phrase that that sometimes your life is the only Bible that people will ever read. And how you conduct yourself says something about the name that you take as Christian. How you conduct yourself, the language that you use, the attitude that you have, how you treat people, it says something. And even then, it's not that you don't fail. It's not that you don't occasionally slip up. I mean, I slip up. I offend people. I do stuff that's out of line. I can snap. I can be, you know, barky with people. But what I try to do is I try to make that the exception and not the rule, such that when that happens, they realize that this is not the best of Steve. This is Steve, having a moment here. But that's all it is. It's just a moment that normally what they're going to find is kindness and gentleness and patience and goodness and grace and truth and love and you know, the best qualities that represent the highest and best, the virtues of Christianity. But even when I do mess up and I do snap at somebody and I bark or whatever and you know, maybe hurt a feeling or two, I come back. I'm very quick on it. I'll come back and, you know, I'll say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I should not have said that. Please forgive me. I'm sorry. You know, and immediately I want to apologize. I want to own that. I want to seek forgiveness. I want to own that. If there's consequences, well, you know, I'll bear that too. But it's one of those things where you want to conduct yourself, and even how you handle your failings becomes a testimony to your Christianity. It becomes a testimony as to who you are and what kind of person you are. And so it is true, I think, that how we conduct ourselves, again, is the only Bible that some people will ever read. The gentleman I was talking with earlier, Jared, he was talking about 2 Corinthians 3 was the verse he used, so I'm going to throw it in here real quick. But in 2 Corinthians 3, Paul says, are we beginning to commend ourselves over again, or do we need as some letters of commendation to you or from you? And here he's talking about the Corinthians. He says, you are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by who? All men. You are the letter. You are known and read by all men. And so in that sense, that it reinforces the statement that how you live, how you conduct yourself, is a testimony to the God that you claim to walk with daily. The one that you claim to be in fellowship, the one that you claim to serve, the one that you claim to represent in this world. And so how we live becomes very important. And so God's name is important, for it represents his divine nature, and he desires that it be honored in all places. Going on in the summary here, yet in Judah God's name was despised. It was thought poorly of. And the table of the Lord was defiled. And he says here, going on in the notes, the priests even complained that the work itself was tiresome. And this led them to, quote, bring what was taken by robbery and what is lame or sick, end quote. And so because they grew weary and tired, they got sloppy and they wound up bringing these unacceptable sacrifices. And then in verse 14, God even rebukes the people, saying, "Cursed be the swindler." Now he's moving away from the priest to the one who's bringing the gift. He says, "Cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows it." In other words, the swindler is the one who goes to his flock and he sees the best of the flock and he says, "That's the one. Out of this 2,500 head of cattle, that's the prime head right there. It's the first, it's the best, and that's the one." And he vows it publicly. He says, "This is the one I'm going to bring." But then somewhere between that vow and the walking into Jerusalem to the temple, something happens. And what happens is you have a switch. So he vows this male in his flock, but then sacrifices a blemished animal to the Lord. So he winds up not giving what he promised to give. And so in this sense, he puts the rebuke upon the people themselves. And this was a disgrace. Again, because God identifies himself as a great king whose name is to be feared by all. Now we're going to see in the next hour how God is going to bring discipline. How, in fact, he's already bringing warning discipline upon them. And God does that. He's gracious that way. He doesn't lower the boom. He comes down, he offers warning discipline. He lets you know, look, if this continues, here's what's going to happen. And so we're going to see in the next part here, when we jump into chapter 2, verses 1 through 9, how God is going to deal with them. Again, very gracious. He's a righteous God. He's a holy God. He's a just God. And he sits upon a throne of justice, and he will rule in justice. But he's also a God of grace, and he extends mercy. And what he's asking of them is humility, and he's asking for obedience. That's what he's asking for, humility and obedience. And so if they will come to the Lord with the right attitude, if they will bring the right sacrifices, and again, you know, he's just trying to restore the health of the relationship is what he's trying to do. And by the way, I've made this comment before that sometimes when we're in that place where we may feel like we're stagnating a little bit, where we feel like things have become a little humdrum, where a little bit of the passion is lost, what I have learned is that if you will obey, if you will truly obey the Lord, that as you begin to walk with him, the passion can be rekindled. The fire can be relit. And I know it's just like for me, there's mornings where I get up, I'm usually up, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's my time that I devote to study throughout the week, where I'm at my computer for 2-3 hours in the morning, and I'm there and I'm reading. Now, when I get up, I'm dreary-eyed, you know, and I'm, you know, drinking my coffee and, you know, trying to get my blood flowing a little bit. And it is a discipline to open up the Word. Of course, you want to surf the net, and you want to get on, see what's going on Facebook, and you know who's put a posting up, and watch the funny stuff with the beaver screaming, you know, sort of thing. And there's humorous stuff on there, and you want to watch a video or two. But again, I have to shut that out. I have to discipline. I've got to open my Bible Works, open my Logos, and just really get in there. And what I find is as I discipline myself to make that happen, then the passion begins to rise, and I get into the text, and I'm studying it, and all of a sudden I find myself really getting going, and I'm wanting to look at my history books and my lexicons and my dictionaries and my commentaries, and I'm wanting to, you know, understand what's going on here. And I find that when I commit myself, that the passion then begins to rise out of the commitment. And sometimes that can be the thing that can restore us and keep us going. If you lose the commitment, then the passion can die very quickly. And you have to get back to the commitment, I think, in order for the passion to be there. That's just me. Maybe I'm... Anyway, so that brings us to the close for Malachi chapter 1, verses 6 through 14.